702. The Naked Scientist.
Yep, it is your chance to ask all those questions, whether they're silly, whether they seem silly to you or don't seem silly to you, or whether, you know, this has been boggling your mind for years. And thank goodness we have the Naked Scientist. That's Dr. Chris Smith, joining us, Chair of Science at the University of Cambridge. And hi there, Chris. It's been a while since we spoke. It's Yuveka here in for Elibuhile today.
Hi, Yuveka. How are you?
Well, you see, my first question is going to be about me. So I'm sitting here with a cracked rib at the moment, okay, because I was at a kiddies party. I was playing with some children, not this past Saturday, the Saturday before that. I fell back, lost my balance and hit something. So I'm sitting with a cracked rib. So as you can imagine, I've heard all the spare rib jokes you can hear over the past week. But I want to know, is it true that women actually do have an extra rib compared to men?
Oh, I thought you were going to go in a totally different direction.
Where did you think I was going to go then?
I'm surprised you can laugh, because it really is extremely painful when you break or crack a rib.
It is.
The answer is no. Although it's a good Bible story, there are 12 sets of ribs in the human body, male or female, and that's the same as the number of vertebrae you have in your thoracic spine. Your thoracic vertebrae are the bones in your backbone that go through your thorax, and each of them has a rib articulating with it on each side. So that's 1 to 12, 12 pairs of ribs. The bottom ribs, though, are what are called floating ribs. Mm. They don't attach to anything, the bottom sets of ribs. They just sort of float inside the muscles. The ones a bit further up the rib cage unite with a cartilage and then join into your sternum at the front. But the ones at the bottom are floating ribs. Those are the ones you could whip out and you'd notice less, but still pretty painful, I would think.
Yeah, I know it is. I haven't taken the painkillers, so I could be on air, thankfully. We'd be getting all kinds of strange questions and you'd be having a very strange conversation with me. But thank you for that. And I just thought we'd clear it up, because I went to actually look and I said, we've got to blame Adam and Eve for that one. We don't have a spare rib, guys. So all of you who've been making fun of me for the past week, it is not true. But we've got to have a couple of questions. Well, as you can imagine, lots for you. So I'm going to ask some that we already had waiting for you. Somebody wants to know, it's a very weird handle they've got. Style, established 1994, that's their handle. But how far must you be for a lightning strike to not be effective? Basically, as opposed to not be struck by lightning, how far from the strike?
I think what's being referred to is, if lightning hits something near you, how far away do you need to be in order to make sure that you're not at risk? And the answer is quite some distance, because there are two things to consider. When lightning hits the ground potential goes up. In other words, you're giving electricity to the ground, and for a while, the voltage in the ground is extremely high. And if you're a very long thing, so you stood with your legs apart, for example, and you've got long legs, or you're an animal like a cow or a horse, where you've got a long body, then it's perfectly possible for part of your body to be at a much higher voltage than the other part of your body. And wherever you have a voltage difference, a current can flow. And there are animals that get electrocuted, not because they're hit directly by lightning, but because lightning strikes nearby and the lightning raises the ground potential. It goes through the body of the long animal and it causes a problem. That's one risk. So the answer is, if you're standing there with your legs apart, you're at higher risk than if your legs are together.
Wow.
The other thing to consider is that there can be side strikes. And there was one of these, I remember being documented, it was about 15 years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think it was. It was a gentleman who presented to hospital with very strange injuries. He fell off his bike or got knocked over and was found unconscious on the ground, I think in an American city. And he had ruptured eardrums, bleeding from his ears, and funny lines down the side of his face and down his front.
What?
And it turned out that he had been running along listening to an MP3 player. Lightning had struck a tree. The tree, obviously not a very good conductor of electricity, had had its potential raised. Lightning had then jumped sideways from the tree onto this man. And the headphones he was wearing are an even better conductor than he was. So the lightning went into the headphones, made it the air inside his ear canals superheated and blasted out his eardrums. And then the wires conducted the electricity down over his body towards his lower abdomen where the MP3 player was. and then down his legs into the ground. And the lines on his body were burn marks where the cables had been superheated because of the high flow of current and burned his skin.
Oh, my goodness.
And some wag said to me, would you think he was listening to Pink Floyd Delicate Sound of Thunder? I hope he made a full recovery.
No, well, I'm sure that's a proper case of wrong place, wrong time, and wrong thing to be doing at that time. But that sounds extremely painful. I feel for that person. I really do. We've got Palosho on the line from Centurion. Let's take a question. Hi there, Palosho.
Hi, Vega. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Palosho.
I'd like to find out, Chris, is it only humans who shed no teeth? And what would be the reason for this?
When you say shed tears, do you mean as in we're the only animals that emotionally cry?
Milk teeth, as in milk teeth.
Oh, milk teeth. I'm sorry, the line wasn't great and it broke up.
Yeah.
No, lots of animals have what we call deciduous dentition. Deciduous as in things falling off like deciduous leaves on a tree. Many animals have a first set of teeth and then a mature or adult set of dentition. And the reason for this is that as you grow, the teeth that fit your jaw and enable you to eat independently when you're small and fit a small jaw are not going to be appropriate for a big jaw. And so the solution that evolution has arrived at is to have two sets of teeth, one of which displaces the initial dentition, the milk teeth. Dogs do this, cats do this. There are lots of species. Other animals, though, and particularly herbivores, don't have just two sets of teeth. They have continuously growing teeth. Rodents also do the same thing. And this is why rodents gnaw on things, because they have to wear down their teeth, because if they don't wear down their teeth, then their mouth can't close properly and they can't chew. So that's why they constantly gnaw on things in order to keep the teeth sharp, but also wear them down. So we're not unusual among mammals in having both primary and secondary dentition.
And that happens with, like, if you notice with puppies and things like that as well. Yeah, that you would
notice
the same thing. Yes, you would if you have pets. And here's a very interesting one, Chris, that came through. It says, I heard about vibrating diet pills that can help one lose weight. How would that work? Would they vibrate the fat in your stomach? I'm aware of many products and weight loss. I've never heard of vibrating diet pills. Have you?
Well, I think whenever the subject of diet and weight loss and health in general comes up, you always have to be extremely cautious about how you interpret any of the information that's presented in sales speak about these sorts of things. These sorts of things are preying mostly on people's insecurity and on people's desire for self-improvement. And you should be really careful you don't get seduced by a good story not supported by the evidence. So if there is a good clinical trial or proper data that supports something, then anybody selling these sorts of things should be able to provide that data and show what it does, to what extent, and also the mechanism. How does it work?
Yeah.
Now, I haven't seen really good compelling data that if I stand on some vibrating surface, I'm going to lose enormous amounts of weight. The only possible explanation I can put this down to is that when you stand on something that's vibrating, you are causing your muscles to lengthen and shorten rapidly. And this is going to make the muscles try to keep up in order to keep you on balance. So your metabolic rate will go up a bit when you do this. But this is not a substitute for proper exercise. Yeah. Taking a walk, taking the stairs is almost certainly going to be better for you and cheaper
than and safer.
Stand on some vibrating platform or hold on to a vibrating pole, which
sounds like pulls.
A good way to make something lose weight. But the thing that would lose weight first is going to be your wallet, not your weight.
And even more worrying, Chris, is that this person is talking about vibrating diet pills. So the short answer there is do not swallow anything that vibrates. Nothing.
No,
don't do that. Okay, a couple of voice notes coming through. Let's take a listen to the first one.
Hi, Dr. Chris. I have a question. I just want to find out what triggers gray hair. I started graying at 25. Now I'm about 37, and just been going on. It's getting worse every time. So I just want to understand what triggers it, because now it is extended to like to other areas. Like I'm becoming gray. Everything is becoming gray.
Oh.
Thanks.
Okay.
Suppose these are from Jovic.
All right. So some.
When he says other areas, I presume he means underarm, between his legs, maybe.
I think he means that the curtains are matching the carpets, or the carpets are matching the something like that. The other way around, whichever way it goes, they're all matching now. So.
I remember seeing a comedy duo on television in the UK called Hale and Pace about 20 years ago, and they used to pretend to be these Swedish gentlemen hanging out in a sauna. And one of them would look at the other and said, people ask us why in Sweden our hair is blonde and our pubes are dark. And the answer is very simple. It's because we dye our pubes. I wouldn't advocate anyone dyes their pubes.
No, please, no.
The mechanism by which, and I'm sorry about your ribs if they now hurt, the mechanism by which hairs go grey is that in the parts of the body that are hairy, you have stem cells that produce the hair. And those stem cells are arranged in a ring which contributes the filaments and the proteins, dead cells that become the hair that extrudes through the skin. And underneath that ring of stem cells is a population of melanin-producing cells called melanocytes. They are the same cells in the skin which give our skin its colour and give us a suntan on a sunny beach. And they add colour almost like wallpapering or painting over the hair with melanin as it forms, so the hair emerges pre-endowed with melanin. And there are different recipes for melanin that mean that the tone or colour of the hair changes from black right through to very, very blonde or even white in some cases, if there's no melanin at all. But as we get older, and we're not sure why it happens mostly to hair follicles and not to skin, something causes the hair follicle melanocytes to senesce. Effectively, they burn out and they stop becoming as effective as to produce melanin that's added to the hair. So over time, the concentration of melanin being added diminishes, which means the hair goes from whatever color it was to a lighter and lighter color, eventually becoming white. And the reason it's white is because that is the natural color of the keratin, which is the protein that the hair is made of. And it's the same stuff that your fingernails are made from. That's keratin as well, which is why if you look at the end of your fingernails, they're a white color. That's what your hair is made of. And hence the hair reverts to its natural white color when these melanocytes stop working. We don't know why they burn out prematurely in some people. And we don't know why they burn out prematurely in some parts of the body over others first. It's an ongoing subject of research.
Okay. All right. Well, now you have your answer. So, you know, now we know why we spend thousands every month just trying to color those grays. And then V wants to know from you, Chris, a baby is formed when a sperm cell and egg cell fuse to form a zygote. At what point in the development of the fetus does the soul enter? Ooh, a spiritual one there for you.
Well, we know that babies are pretty much formed and recognizable as a developing baby within a matter of, well, within 12 weeks, you've got a baby that you would recognize as a baby. And within less time than that, you have a heartbeat and you already have a nervous system forming and beginning to build itself within that time. And by about 20 weeks, then that baby's nervous system is responding to stimuli. And there's evidence that babies in their mid-20s of weeks of development, so like 24, 25 weeks, apart from being completely viable, if they're delivered early, you can save a baby that's delivered early from about 24 weeks now. But those babies will respond to stimuli, including face-shaped lights shone through the wall of the uterus, and also sounds as well, especially their mum's voice. You can see changes in neural activity. Now, if we think that the soul is part and parcel of who you are, and you are the product of what your nervous system is doing, then your soul is building itself from the minute that the brain activity is formed and begins to get going, isn't it? So very early on in pregnancy would be the answer.
Okay, well, very interesting. I wondered how spiritual, you know, we were going to get with that one. But we've got Patrick from Krugersdorp with a question for you. Chris, hi there, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. You have a question for Chris?
Yes, I do have a question for Chris, and it's a very interesting one. I just want to find out why during the day when the temperature is 16 degrees Celsius, we feel very, very cold. But when it's 16 degrees Celsius at night, you can even sleep naked. I just want to know, because it's very, very warm, why during the day when it's 16 degrees Celsius, we feel cold, and when it's at night, we feel very warm. I think that's very interesting.
I don't know if I've ever experienced that, but yes. on yours, Chris.
Probably one has to bear in mind that there's going to be a lot of placebo effect in this. In other words, that because you're expecting it to feel warmer or colder accordingly, it tends to fulfill your expectation. And secondly, the conditions that associate with each of those sorts of conditions are going to be quite different. 16 degrees at night, that's quite warm. And so therefore, it's probably a warmer time of year. Therefore, the environment around you, although the air temperature is falling to 16 degrees, the environment around you may well be much warmer. Therefore, you're having radiated at you heat, which is latent within the things around you, the floor, the buildings, the cars and so on. Whereas during the day, if it's only 16 degrees, probably the things around you are even colder and the sun is struggling to warm the surfaces up to about 16 degrees. So therefore, you're not seeing that input from the environment around you. So it feels colder. And you've also got other things like wind chill. It might be rainy as well. So these other factors will contribute to it also feeling even more cold than it actually is.
And you're probably under a ton of blankets at night anyway, so which is why you can sleep naked. Patrick, at that point. Okay, so a couple more questions coming through. The one wants to know, do all growth plates in a human being close? I think they mean close at the same time. Do all growth plates, that's from Ntala, wants to know, do all growth plates in a growing human being close at the same time?
Well, first of all, what's a growth plate? Our body builds itself and builds bones in two ways. And one of them is called endochondral ossification. And that means endo within chondral cartilage. So you ossify, make bone inside cartilage. The other form is called intramembranous ossification. And this is where bones just grow as a sheet inside tissue. And so the sorts of bones that do that are things like your jawbone and your skull is intramembranous ossification. Whereas the long bones need to make a cartilage model that they then make hard. And as we get older, the growth plate where the cartilage is, which is adding cartilage inside the bone, the long bit of the bone, this slowly gets narrower and narrower. And when the two sides that are bony meet, the growth plate is said to fuse. And that's when no further growth is possible because you've lost the supply of new cartilage that was being made to make a model and then filled in with bone. So our long bones, like our arms, the humerus, for example, your femurs, those follow this pattern of endochondral ossification. And there is a window of development as this occurs. And by the time you get to about 16, 17 in boys, maybe 18 if you're lucky, but a bit younger in girls, those growth plates will come together, and once they do, no further growth of that bone is possible. The exception of the bones that I said grow by intramembranous ossification, your skull bones, your jaw bones, for example. And this is why some diseases which are related to the release of growth hormones can continue to make those bones get bigger, but not, they don't make you taller.
Okay.
And as you go through development, those growth plates will tend to fuse at roughly the same time so that your skeleton remains symmetrical. Because if one side grew and didn't fuse at the same time as the other side, you'd end up with a wonky skeleton. So the body does try to time the closure of the growth plates to keep your skeleton in proportion and symmetrical.
All right. Well, Chris, I think we have time for just one more voice note. Let's take one quickly.
Hello, Eureka and the Naked Scientist. Oh, it's a pleasure to listen to him. Doc, here's a quick question. Is there anything like rebirth of humans? You know, the reason why I'm saying that is because I'm actually living in a different country, not in South Africa. And the other day when I was in the store, I saw someone who looked exactly like my sister. I tell you, not like me, but my sister. And my friend. And the other time I saw someone who really resembles my friend, but the one who resembles my sister, I even asked her if she has a family member in South Africa or a family member who looks like me, you know. It was quite funny, and she said no. So is there anything like that?
Okay.
I guess it's a big question.
All right, Chris, I don't know if she's talking about reincarnation or doppelgangers or something, but we've got like 20 seconds to answer that one if we can, please. I'm not sure exactly.
You are genetically unique. There's no one on Earth, unless you have an identical twin, who is genetically the same as you, but there are lots of people with many of the same genes as you. And therefore, given there are lots of people on Earth, there are lots of people who have some of the same combinations of genes, which will make them have some of the same features that you do, so they can look uncannily like you, which is why, after all, we look like brothers and sisters, because they share more of those genes than someone picked at random. But there therefore will still be people in the population who may well have enough of those genes to give us some of the features that make us look uncannily similar.
Okay, like I was told, I look like, what is it, a certain supermodel? I'm not going to add it, I can't remember which one. But thank you, Chris. Thanks so much. Always a pleasure. Always informative.
It's a pleasure. See you soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.